to answer a very straightforward question. How can we imagine a future for Gaza as part of the broader struggle for Palestinian liberation?
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman.
And I'm Asa Winstanley.
Welcome back to the Electronic Intifada podcast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. A new literary anthology, Light in Gaza, Writings Born of Fire, has just been published from Haymarket Books, a book that imagines what a future in Gaza could be in an attempt, as one of our guests and the co-editor of the book, Jihad Abu Salem, says, to break the intellectual blockade on Gaza. Jean-Pierre Filliou, author of Gaza, A History, says about the book, quote, as Mahmoud Darwish wrote as early as 1973, we do injustice to Gaza when we turn it into a myth. This is why Light in Gaza, through its insightful collection of essays and poems, offers such a unique picture of the Palestinian experience in a territory cut off from the world for a decade and a half. We're delighted to have Jihad, as well as two of the contributors to Light in Gaza, Writings Born of Fire, on with us today, Asma Abu Muzaid and Yusuf Al-Jamal. Jihad, Asma, and Yusuf, thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on the publication of this anthology.
Thanks for having us. Thank you.
Jihad, let's start with you, as you're one of the co-editors, and this is a project of the American Friends Service Committee, where you are the Education and Policy Associate at the Palestine Activism Program. Give us a sense of the scope of this book.
This book seeks to answer a very straightforward question. How can we imagine a future for Gaza as part of the broader struggle for Palestinian liberation? And I think the answer lies in the common thread that brings together, combines all the pieces and chapters and poems and even wonderful photos that people will see in the book. The answer is simple. The Nakba has got to end. The Nakba, the catastrophe that befell Palestinians in 1948, was not just an event relegated to a specific point in time. The expulsion of Palestinians, the Israel's efforts to remove Palestinians from their lands, to render them as refugees behind fences so that it can maintain its Jewish majority formula. All these are processes that started before and during 1948, during the Nakba, and still continue until today. And we, in the book, we look at Gaza as an example of how the Nakba continues today. And we try to think about the several aspects of Gaza's experience and within this framework. So the book is about framing, it's about analysis, and it's about the richness and the diversity of the Palestinian experience of Gaza. And most importantly, it's about conveying the voice of Palestinians in Gaza to the outside world and making their voices heard.
Asma, tell us a little bit about yourself and your work as a writer and as one of the contributors to this anthology.
Thank you, Nora. So I consider myself a beginner gardener. And it's ironic because I started my gardening journey because it's related to my work. So I wanted to connect with nature, but also to understand the experiences of the women that I work with. And one fact that it was interesting for me to see is that I had a one type of flower that I was trying to grow, and it lasted a year without blooming. So I was like almost ready to give up. And for me, it was interesting that only during the aggression of 2021, when like things were about like just give up. It bloomed. And I felt like it's a message for me to continue. And that was also through the process of writing the chapter. My work in the book is looking at the lost identity, the lost Palestinian identity between agriculture and environment. And I'm trying to look at our grandparents' relationship to the land, to the agriculture as a profession, but also as a part of a movement of resistance that Palestinian farmers has been leading, and Gaza in particular, what does it mean for it? So it's a lot inspired from my own grandparents who are farmers by heart and by profession, but it's also a reflection on what does farming mean to us now in Gaza with all the restriction that we are seeing, with all the very systematic attack on agriculture as a profession, but in its essence as an attack on agriculture as an identity as well.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? The essay that is in the book is called On Why We Still Hold Onto Our Phones and Keep Recording. And, you know, just the title of that kind of struck me because, you know, we're coming off of the heels of yet another brutal Israeli assault on Gaza just last month. Can you talk about why, you know, what that title means and kind of the, you know, how it relates to not just, you know, something that you witnessed last year, but something that keeps happening again and again?
So during the aggression last year, like the amount of guilt that we felt because we are every single day we woke up and we are the lucky ones who survived. But also the fact that we have to sit on screen to monitor everything is happening, but also get exposed to the discussion that dehumanize you, that put you in a space that you have to prove that you are worthy of even breathing or even taking a space to speak, was something really suffocating. But what I felt most important is not that we should write to them. Actually, we should write to ourselves. And I think this is something we tend to forget. But with generations after generation, that kind of collective memory is not something that is preserved. And I've seen it with my work on the chapter on agriculture. And I felt it's important for us to document and write and record, because later on in 20 years' time, there will be people who will tell us and make us feel that we have not done enough, that we have run away, we were cowards. So it was not really for them. It was only for our future generation that, you know, you need to understand what we went through, and you need to understand like how we continue to do our work to survive, and to take that knowledge as a way of strength to also continue.
Thanks, Esma. Yusuf, you're a longtime writer and journalist. You've contributed to the Electronic Intifada many times. Tell us about your essay, which is called Travel Restrictions as a Manifestation of Nakba, Gaza, the Path Backwards is the Path Forward. Tell us about your essay and what it entails.
Thank you for having us today. As you know, some of the writings that I have published with the Electronic Intifada address the issue of travel restrictions from a personal perspective. It doesn't mean that, you know, the situation or the experience of my family in Gaza vis-a-vis travel restrictions is unique. It's not, but it's a personal representation of this collective experience, travel restrictions and how they affect, you know, our lives, how they affect patients. I have written about, you know, my sister, for example, being denied a permit to have a minor surgery in Jerusalem and losing her life. About my mother trying to get a permit for 12 years to visit her own family in the West Bank. And I thought that this is the best way to tell the story, to connect it with the personal, because people do relate to personal stories. So my chapter in the book argues that for Gaza to live a better future, travel restrictions have to be lifted and removed altogether, so that Gaza could connect with the outside world on one hand, and could also connect with the rest of Palestine, with the West Bank and what is today Israel, for Palestinians to be able to travel freely, so that no Palestinian would have to wait, you know, for the borders to open, or you know, cancer patients wouldn't have to wait for Israeli permits to get their medication, and many of them actually have lost their lives. So my chapter asks for, you know, leaving these restrictions, and showing how if the how when these restrictions are lifted, that Palestinian lives could improve, that we could go back to the original settings when Gaza was connected with the rest of Palestine and the rest of the world, the same as the situation or the case was before 1948. Where we could, as a family, be united. You know, I haven't seen my family in a single place since I was born, because we are divided by restrictions, by checkpoints, by borders, by permits. I have family everywhere, almost in the region, in Jordan, in the Gulf, in Europe, in the U.S., but we cannot meet in a single place. So. For Gaza to move forward, we have to go back to the original settings, that is when Gaza was connected with the rest of Palestine. And under these circumstances, people could travel freely. Students wouldn't have to lose their scholarships because the border is shut down, or because a checkpoint is not allowing them to leave. And in this case, as I said, patients wouldn't have to die. We as a family could be in one place. And, you know, one of the main targets of Israel's occupation has been the fabric of Palestinian families and the Palestinian society as a whole. So breaking down families is part of this ongoing Nakba that Jihad addressed at the beginning of his intervention, that, you know, what is happening today in Gaza, this siege and these travel restrictions are continuing since 1948. They are a continuation of the ongoing Nakba that we have relived many times and we are still living every day.
Absolutely. Part of this book is not just talking about what has happened and what keeps happening to Gaza, but also what could be Gaza's future? What does it mean for both of you, Asma, maybe you can start, to reimagine Gaza apart from its designation as, you know, an open air prison or a massive research and development factory for Israeli weapons, or, you know, the home to 2 million people, 80% of whom are refugees? How do we talk about Gaza in terms of the future and in terms of preserving identity, culture, and liberation struggle?
I think one of the things that we've done in the book and also in the chapter is tracking that history. And I think in tracking the history and having that macro lens on how identity evolved in terms of agriculture and environment, for example, it really shows you the magnitude of a systematic attack on this identity, and how even the basics that would preserve a future that could support a different future is undermined in every way. But also that there are attempts, always there is attempts of reclaiming who we are and reclaiming what we want to do. But I also warn against the romanticization of these attempts, because it has a reserve that is not endless, and that there is so many things that needs to be done. To be honest, I ended the chapter while writing it with a message of hope and a reimagining. And then the May aggression happened. And I talked to my editor and I told her I want to take back and I want to change the ending because honestly, without stopping what's happening in Gaza, without the end of the blockade and the occupation, any future will only put the burden on Palestinians in Gaza to imagine a future that is, you know, bright future. And that's in itself a narrative that we should call it out and we should fight it. There are so many attempts. I can't tell you about the attempts of people like gathering, you know, local seeds and trying to preserve the little that exists. But then we cannot ignore how economic and social deterioration is affecting and suffocating even these spaces. And the need for even Palestinian in the diaspora and everywhere to be aware of that, to know that there is a relentless effort that needs to be taken in place, not only during aggression, but during all year long.
Yusuf or Jihad, did you want to add to that?
I think I agree with Asma. So the situation is catastrophic in many different ways. There is an ongoing tragedy that also cannot be separated from the whole, you know, Nakba, the whole tragedy that is taking place in Palestine every day. And people need to be aware of that. People should know that, you know, the impact of the 15-year-old siege on Gaza, on people losing their lives, but most importantly, losing, you know, the belief that a solution could be reached. We have people who have lost hope, but at the same time, there are some people who are trying to struggle and survive, and despite the, you know, the struggles and difficulties, they're trying to somehow get through and build their own future. We have a very good IT community in Gaza. People are trying to build their own startups, for example, or small projects. But again, the whole picture, we cannot separate this from the challenges people face. We have people working on, for example, solutions for contaminated, you know, water, or you know, 97% of Gaza's water is unfit for human consumption. We have people working to solve this problem, but again, we have a long way to go on many different levels. Romanticizing life in Gaza, I think, is more harmful than beneficial to the people of Gaza. And that's why when many delegations used to come to Gaza when I was there, I would take them to the most impoverished, you know, areas in Gaza so that they could see the impact the siege had on people, because this is real life. The majority of people live this life in Gaza today. Unfortunately, 15 years on, the siege has not ended. It's getting worse every day. But at the same time, we want to highlight that the people who are resisting, the people who did not lose hope, they're doing their best to survive and, you know, continue their lives under these circumstances, that they are also thinking of the future and solutions, not just for Gaza, but the whole, you know, situation, the occupation, settler colonialism in Palestine, that they see themselves as part of this liberation project. And that's why, for example, we have the Great March of Return. We had the Great March of Return. It's not only about Gaza. It's also about the rest of Palestine. And that's why also you see people from Gaza following the news of Palestinians in the West Bank and today's Israel, because we cannot separate, you know, these communities. And the people in Gaza to think of the, you know, of Palestinians in the diaspora and elsewhere, they see themselves as part of one project. But at the same time, they want to tell the world that the impact of siege on them had been very catastrophic, and the image is not very bright, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, it reminds me of, you know, all of the very small NGO projects that, you know, these like the US and the EU and Canada like to tout as, you know, we are doing something for the Palestinian people while still sending, you know, billions and billions of dollars to support Israel at every turn and resupply Israel with weapons when it wants to bomb Gaza or, you know, so it's like these very piecemeal sort of tokenization and really like a dehumanization project of Palestinians, like they don't know how to support themselves. So the EU is going to do something, you know, to help, you know, whereas this is not what Palestinians need in terms of a liberation struggle and support for that. Jihad, did you want to talk a little bit about imagining this future in that context?
Sure. The book does not provide clear-cut recipes for what the future should look like. And this is important to say here because, you know, the contributors to the book do not necessarily represent the multiplicity of opinion in Palestine. We tried to capture as many perspectives as we can, and we tried to portray a complex picture about how Palestinians in Gaza, from Gaza, in Gaza, and outside Gaza, and one of the authors is actually from the West Bank who has never stepped foot in Gaza, but you know, Suhail Taha, you will read his chapter on electricity and what the power crisis does to people there. It's a pretty fascinating piece. So we tried to bring together all these perspectives in the book to portray this picture, to show that, you know, here are some of the conversations that these authors are having, and they are representative of some of the discussions that are ongoing in the Palestinian street, on social media, in the civil society, academic and scholarly circles, and so on and so forth. But I think what's more important about the book is its politics and the kind of analysis it encourages people to embrace when thinking about Gaza. And again, I would like to reiterate my initial point about the historical context that surrounds Gaza. And speaking of all the, you know, the band-aids, right, that the international community has been, you know, has tried for decades to use to manage the situation, to control Gaza, to tame Gaza, without any of these solutions actually working out. So it's a matter of politics, and it's a matter of analysis, and it's a matter of how do we understand Gaza. And to understand Gaza, we need to go back to 1948. We need to go back to that moment when a part of Palestine, the Gaza district, which was one of the historic Palestine's largest administrative districts, was reduced in size and cut from the rest of historic Palestine, was turned into the Gaza Strip that we know today, and where hundreds of thousands of Palestinians were pushed towards the southwest and towards the west, and to be made refugees. People, when Palestinians ended up in Gaza in 1948, they weren't planning on staying there for decades. They weren't planning on staying in the Gaza Strip as refugees, living in 8 refugee camps. These people had land, had property. They lived in cities and towns with dignity and honor. But here we are, it's 2022, and you know, the Gaza Strip is this small geographic area that is confined and fenced off from the rest of the world, just so that Israel can maintain its Jewish majority. I mean, if we look at the numbers, the rate of population density in Gaza today revolves around 6,000 to 7,000 human beings in a square kilometer. In American terms, that's 13,000 persons per a square mile. And by 2050, this will double. So we're talking about a Gaza Strip with 4.5 million people, where the population density will reach 35,000 human beings per a square mile. We're talking about an impoverished, small strip of land that lacks resources, that lacks the ability to support the people who live in it to maintain their physical well-being. And yes, people in Gaza are fighters. They have been resisting. They will continue to resist. And they're willing to put up a fight, you know, and Gaza is an example of how a group of people will refuse to be, you know, to see their rights reduced from political ones about the liberation, self-determination into, you know, just a humanitarian case of begging for bones. No, that's not what Gaza is about. And that's why we wanted to push for a fresh and brave political understanding of what is wrong with our current understanding and approach, especially in the context of the international community when it comes to Gaza. And I talk about this in the introduction to the book. And I talk about how, for example, the so-called two-state solution, which is internationally accepted and promoted as the solution for the Palestine question, it does not and will not help Gaza, because there are no practical solutions even for, you know, the questions such as demographic expansion and growth, right? Like Israel today justifies its settlement expansion in the West Bank on the basis of natural population growth. But nobody is talking about natural population growth in Gaza. Where are these people going to go? If Israel continues to colonize the West Bank, then are these Palestinians in Gaza, this population that has been growing, supposed to move into parts of the West Bank when they are part of a Palestinian state, according to the two-state solution? There are no answers. Nobody is willing to answer these existential questions. So, and that shows that we need to go back to 1948. We need to address the processes that have been set in motion since 1948. These are structural processes and issues that are about maintaining the privileges and superiority and power of a certain group at the expense of another. It's as simple as that, and that's the message of the book.
Thank you, Jihad. Asma, what do you hope readers take away from this collection?
The journey of writing the book was very enlightening for me because interestingly enough, there isn't spaces to talk about our identity from an agricultural and environmental lens. And in my journey of writing this chapter, I started appreciating or actually like just walking by a tree and like trying to guess how old is this tree, because like one tree that was near my grandparents' house was planted in 1956. And it's still there. It has a social significance. But then we no longer linger on these resemblance of identity and significance of identity. And I think it's something very important for us as Palestinians to reconnect to what land is. Land and agriculture is beyond livelihood. Livelihood and having, you know, food on your table is one aspect. But historically, as Jihad mentioned, and we need to look at that historically, agriculture was a collective action. It was an action where people can collectively organize and work together to have the harvest. And that collective spirit was also very beneficial in terms of like resistance, in terms of even, you know, social change as well. Unfortunately, the more we have diminishing agricultural spaces, spaces with the demographic expansion, the more we are seeing a shift in that and a loss of that collective organizing, that collective spirit that we use, it used to be part of our identity. What I really want readers to take for Palestinian, I wish that this is a space for them to reflect a lot. And I explain in some part, we like to wear necklaces of, you know, olive trees, but we don't think about the experience of the farmer on a daily basis of how he maintains that olive tree despite all the attack on that olive tree. So to buy a necklace is something good, but to support Palestinian product and to support the local Palestinian product and creating a demand for this Palestinian product is something that will help these farmers to continue, you know, being a resistance and to continue their work on that angle. For other like readers, I think and I hope that reading the book in general would give people an insight on how we think as Palestinian in Gaza, and also what does Gaza mean. I always, when people come to Gaza, in a very few days, and suddenly they realize that they know Gaza more than us. And they stay in the fanciest places and judge how Gaza is no need of, like, you know, support and so on. I really tell them that, in my opinion, Gaza is like a very old lady. If you look at her face, you have so much wrinkles that should tell a story of what it has gone through. What does that lady is telling you to listen to, and where she has reached that old age, and what was the cost on her health, on her body, and even in her spirit to reach that age. And I hope that the book is an attempt for people to listen to that lady, telling them her story, with her voices, with her experiences, and to listen, and to give that spaces for Palestinians from Gaza to speak and tell their story.
Yusuf, did you want to add to that? What do you hope readers take away from your essay and the essays of your colleagues in this anthology?
I think one important thing that if this book achieves would be a great success is that, as you know, Palestinians have always been dehumanized and reduced into statistics and numbers. So I hope that these stories and chapters and personal experiences will push people to think and connect with the Palestinian people. For example, when we talk about travel restrictions and say 10,000 people were denied permits, for example, to travel to the West Bank, or were not able, you know, the 100 students were not able to travel through the Rafah crossing and lost their scholarships, let's say this year, that they connect with these people because these people have, you know, personal stories, they have families, they have history, they have hopes and aspirations they want to achieve. And by reading, you know, these stories, that people will be able to connect with the normal Palestinian on the ground in Gaza and elsewhere in Palestine. Like when they travel, for example, when they cross a border, when they get to an airport, or when they get on a flight, they will remember Palestinians who cannot. And they work to end this injustice, especially that in some cases, like the case of the US, for example, this is happening because of the US tax money given to Israel every year to maintain this system of apartheid and military occupation. So people would take action so that when they feel that the story of Palestinians in Gaza matters to them and means something to them, that they will take political action on a grassroots level, on an institutional level, on a political level, to bring about change. And we've seen some of these initiatives recently, for example, taking place at the US Congress, some resolutions to link U.S. aid to Israel to the treatment of Palestinians and respecting the human rights of the Palestinians, including Palestinian children. So hopefully this will also bring about change. We wrote these stories not because we enjoy writing about our tragedies. Retelling these stories is very painful to us every time, especially when we talk about personal tragedies. But we write about these personal tragedies and destruction and death because we hope that our future will be better than our past, or our tomorrow is better than our yesterday, and which means that a political change will happen. So people will, who will read the book and the chapters will try to bring about political change to end the siege and the occupation of Gaza and the rest of Palestine.
Yusuf Ajamal, Asma Abu Muzaid, and Jihad Abu Salem, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast. The book, again, is called Light in Gaza, Writings Born of Fire, published by Haymarket Books. Jihad is one of the editors, along with Jennifer Bing and Michael Merriman-Lotz. We'll have links to the book itself and more about some of its authors on the Electronic Intifada podcast blog post that accompanies this episode. Thank you all so much, and congratulations again on the book.
Thank you, Nora.
Thank you.
Thanks for watching this video. Please subscribe to our YouTube channel, hit like, leave a comment. These engagements help us with the YouTube algorithm, and it helps us to get around Silicon Valley censorship as much as possible. It does make a difference. You can also support our journalism by going to electronicintifada.net and clicking on Donate Now. Thank you.